Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained. And it's a great honor to have you on the show tonight. Welcome, Deepak Chopra.
Thank you.
Yes, this is Uri.
Hi, Uri. It's Nicole Whitney calling News for the Soul. Welcome to News for the Soul, Robert Allen.
Thank you, Nicole. It's great to be here with you tonight.
Why are you here? We're talking to Carolyn Mace about Sacred Contracts, one of her many best-selling books. Welcome to the show, Greg Braden.
Well, good evening, Nicole. It's certainly a pleasure to hear your voice and a pleasure to be here tonight.
Welcome to the show, Stuart Wild.
Thank you very much.
John Kehoe, welcome to News for the Soul.
Hey, how are you?
Next up, Dr. David Morehouse.
I'm so glad that you called me because you are doing such an important task, important work, because you are spreading a very positive message.
I was really moved by last week's show because we made a commitment to a worldwide event to try to change consciousness.
I'm feeling enormous energy around this show, just enormous. I really have to hand it to you, Nicole. You've created sort of a niche of amazing connections. It's just like the angels and the devatas that are like attracted to News for the Soul is amazing.
Listening to the News for the Soul Radio Network.
It's time now for Planning on Purpose with Stacy Walters. Stacy, an estate planning lawyer based in North Carolina, lives to help others. In 2008, her 5-month-old daughter, Shayla's heart stopped unexpectedly, causing brain damage that left her severely disabled. This served as a calling for Stacy that renewed her spirit of serving others by focusing her law practice on protecting and preparing families for unexpected life events and end-of-life issues. Let's take one step closer to peace of mind. Here's Stacy now.
Hi, good evening. So good to be back. This is Attorney Stacy Walters. I am in North Carolina. Licensed attorney with Thomas Walters Estate Planning and Probate Attorneys. And all we do is focus on wills, trust, powers of attorney, probate, and all that stuff that we all really need in order to plan for life. You know, today's topic is it's never too late until it is. You know, we've all grown up hearing, you know, it's never too late. Well, in my arena, it definitely comes to a point where it's too late. And so today what we're going to visit is, well, what do we do when it is too late? So I have a bunch of different scenarios and stories that we're going to talk about today. I wanted to start off with, you know, something kind of classic that has happened at least a couple of times in more recent memory. Just last week, I had a daughter contact me and she says, hey, listen, you know, mom's getting worse and I take care of her and I'm getting to a point where I feel like I need to have more authority to be able to take care of her. And I said, well, does she have a power of attorney? No, she doesn't have a power of attorney. Okay. Does she have a health care power of attorney? So if she can't make her own medical care decisions, you can do that. Nope, doesn't have that, okay. Well, does she have something called a living will? That's an advanced directive that if she needs life support where she's going to direct the doctors and direct her health care power of attorney what it is that she wants them to do. And she says, nope, we don't have that. Well, does she have a will? Yep, she does. It's from 1974. Oh, my goodness, okay. Well, how about if you send me the will I told her, and I'll take a look. I want to see if we should anticipate any problems with it. And she says, oh, I know we're already going to have problems. I said, okay, what kind of problems are you aware of? And she says, well, the two executors named back in 1974 were her sister and her brother-in-law, and they're both dead. Okay, well, that's okay because you, as the daughter, could petition to be the executor. So I'm not quite so worried about that. But I do want to see if it has been properly executed. So I got a copy of the will, and it was pretty short and sweet to be a will. It was only about 2 pages long. And it had been witnessed by three witnesses. And that is a requirement, or used to be a requirement in North Carolina. It's still a requirement in a lot of states. North Carolina now requires it to be witnessed by two. And I said to her, do you know who these witnesses are? She says, well, I can tell you that's my aunt right there that passed away. And that's all she had to say. Because her will was not what's called self-proving. So in North Carolina, when you've executed a will, and it's not self-proving, your witnesses have to come into court and they have to attest, in other words, swear, that that's their handwriting and that they were in front of you when you signed and that you were competent over age 18 and not under any type of undue influence. So there lied the problem. The clerk of court was never going to be able to deem that this was a valid will, and assets were going to then be distributed in accordance with North Carolina law, just as if this lady died without a will. Now, I had the opportunity to talk with her, and she did want to make some changes to her will in terms of her specific bequest, who she wanted to leave her stuff to. So we were working through some of the issues, and I realized along the way that, you know, Mom had some competency concerns for me. As a young lawyer, I was trained by a much wiser and older attorney who had been doing this a lot longer than me, Stacy. Try to err on the side of competence. This isn't like a doctor-patient relationship. If you know your client, even if they don't remember certain things, but you know that what they're trying to have happen is in accordance with any expressed wishes in the past. So in other words, they're not trying to just completely turn things upside down where you might be worried that they've been brainwashed, there's been some elder abuse, that they truly aren't competent and they're just saying what the family member wants to say, or sometimes they're not even saying anything at all and they're letting the family member do all the talking. Do your due diligence, but when possible, err on the side of competence. I always kind of wondered initially why he said that to me, and we're going to learn in just a minute why he said that to me. So fast forward, I've been, you know, working with this, we call them prospects. They're not my clients, just to try to get to a point where we might be able to engage services. And I got a frantic text from her daughter. I think it was late Saturday night this past weekend. Mom suffered a massive stroke. We need to move forward. I'm ready to pay you the money, and we've got to get going. Uh-oh. Okay, so Mom, I figured out, has Alzheimer's. Yes, she lacks some competency. I did feel that I would be able to move forward with her legal documents, but not when she suffered a massive stroke. Mom lost her level of competency with a massive stroke, and I was not going to be able to find her competent. And so the daughter, and I told her, I said, there's nothing I can do at this point. I can't draft powers of attorney and she signs them because she doesn't have the level of competency. And so she said, well, what do I do? Well, you're going to have to go through something called a guardianship. So, well, what does that involve? She said, can you do that? Well, I could, but it's a court proceeding, and it's going to take a while. And honestly, my practice right now, I've got too much going on to, you know, cater to the court and their schedule and go to a hearing and gather medical records and, you know, get the sheriff the information that has to be served on your mom and communicate with the social worker and go through all sorts of questions and prepare for a hearing. Because what happens is the judge has to review everything and has to determine whether your mom is competent or not before anyone will have legal authority, even do basic things like write a check to pay her bills, cash a check, just those basic things. plus everything else. So I did refer her out. It was sad, though, because it was too late. It was almost too late when they came to talk to me, but now it's definitely too late. You see, once you've reached a point when we're alive, but we don't have the ability to make informed decisions, when we lack the capacity to know what we're signing, when we aren't able to understand what's before us legally, then us lawyers cannot help as easily as if we had planned ahead. And so that's what I mean by it's never too late until it is. The sad part of all of this is now it's going to cost them a lot more money to go through a guardianship. The process is not quick. It usually takes 2 to 3 months here in North Carolina, depending on the county and the backlog. And in the meantime, they're in limbo. They can't do anything to help mom. So who's going to pay? Let's just talk about the electric bill at our house. Who's going to pay that if they can't sign the check? Well, that's going to be probably right out of their pocket until they can, and then they can reimburse themselves. So that's why I love what I do, because I'm all about planning. I'm very proactive. I don't like being behind the eight ball, and it's really emotionally difficult when our clients, our prospect clients, the families that we care about, we sit with, and they are behind the eight ball. I want to share another story with you. You know, this one, you know, mom was relatively up in years and already had a terminal diagnosis of Alzheimer's, but I want to share one with you that really was a heartfelt, I guess, blow, if you will, when I found out what was going on. So I do public seminars, and this is where I educate people all about estate planning. And I had a lovely couple attend one of my seminars. I put them probably in, you know, their late 60s, maybe early 70s, and they were interested in learning more. So they set a time to come in and sit and just have a visit with me and just learn more about what they don't know and talk more personally about what their goals are and things that they want to have and things they don't want to happen. So a couple days maybe before, we were doing our reminder calls, and the woman said, "My husband says he doesn't want to do this right now." And honestly, estate planning is very interesting. It's that old adage, you can bring the horse to the water, but you can't make him drink. People are on their own path, their own pace. It's their own journey. And there's no one out there that I'm ever going to convince that they have to do this, they need to do this, they should do this if they aren't ready. So I just recognize it as, you know, these people aren't ready. They didn't have any documents whatsoever in place. Now, interestingly, this is a blended family. And so about 10 or 14 days after their initial appointment that got canceled, they canceled it, I got a phone call from her. And she was devastated. He had been standing on a ladder upstairs in their hallway changing a light bulb. And he fell down the stairs, fell off the ladder down the stairs. And he suffered a brain bleed, traumatic brain injury. Now, what they couldn't figure out was the reason he fell because he was having a stroke, or did he have a stroke because he fell? She came in and sat with me and showed me a video of him. Gosh, I'd just seen him 3 weeks before, and he didn't know where he was. He lost the majority of his fine motor skills, his gross motor skills. He couldn't walk. He couldn't talk. Somebody had to feed him. He was conscious, but definitely was not competent, not able to make his own decisions. And so she said, "What do I do? I mean, I've been with my husband for quite a while, and his kids, they're really upset, and they're trying to, you know, tell me what to do, and I don't know what to do." So being a blended family, we're talking about her stepkids, and this is where all that planning really comes in is, you know, if, and I told her this, if I would have seen you a few weeks ago, we're pretty streamlined, and we try really hard to get everything in place as quick as possible because I always see it as a gamble. And I don't want anything to happen on my watch. In other words, I want to work as quick as we can to make sure you have your perfect plan in place. I said, so if we would have gone that direction, maybe, maybe not, we would have had powers of attorney in place, but you don't now. And you can't do the things that you need to do for your husband. So you're going to have to go through a guardianship proceeding. So I explained to her, you know, what that was, which we just talked about. And she says, okay, well, I guess I'll go back and I'll talk to his kids. So a little while later, probably 2-3 days maybe, she calls and she says, this is just too much for me. I mean, he was just here and I don't know, I don't think he's ever going to recover. We're looking at long-term care in a nursing home now. We don't have the money to pay for it. I don't know what to do, and it's just so overwhelming. His son is going to apply for a guardianship. What that meant was her husband's assets, even if it's 50-50 between the husband and the wife, so let's just pick on a joint checking account. So if it's a joint checking account, the law deems it 50-50, son-in-law now will have control over that checking account as well as her, and he has to account for the rest of his father's life back and forth to the court what he's done with that money to benefit his father. So the spouse, the wife, lost control over assets that they own jointly. They have to be accounted for through now the court process for as long as he lives. And, you know, they did what they had to do to make sure that he was cared for and that they could make decisions for him, that they could take care of his expenses. But now all of a sudden, what were marital assets now are controlled by a stepson, unnecessarily, where if they just had a power of attorney, the wife still would have been able to carry forward and make decisions for him. Now, we didn't keep in touch. I don't know if she ever got her own estate plan and necessary documents in place. But I can tell you, if they came to the conclusion that there wasn't any hope, that this was a permanent condition, that he was going to need life support for the rest of his life, they would not be able to make those decisions. They'd have to wait for the doctors to come to the conclusion that there's just no more hope and everything that they're doing is detrimental. All of it in accordance with risk management, along with their own code of ethics. You know, that leads me to story. In North Carolina, as with a lot of states, we don't have our own ability to issue what we call a do not resuscitate, a DNR. A DNR means if somebody finds you not breathing, you're in cardiac arrest, don't try to resuscitate me. Don't touch me. Leave me alone. And we do not have authority as citizens here in North Carolina to be able to issue our own do not resuscitate orders. Now, most people would say, well, listen, if I was in a car crash, I certainly would want them to be able to try to resuscitate me. Well, of course you would. But imagine you're in a car crash, but you have terminal stage 4 pancreatic cancer, and you've been given a short time to live. Would you want them to bring you back to suffer through that if you were in a car crash and died? Well, the answer most people are going to say is no, heck no, let me go. So, Carolina, we do have the ability through conversations with our doctors to ask for a DNR, and it's a doctor's order that then the paramedics, for example, would follow. Many of you, though, remember the case of Karen Ann Quinlan. This was a big right-to-die case. Karen Ann Quinlan was born in 1954. When she was only age 21, she was headed out on her own. She had her own apartment, and her friends threw her a party. And she fell into a coma after she consumed Valium with alcohol. She suffered a severe brain injury, a cardiac arrest that lasted between 15 to 20 minutes. When they resuscitated her, she was in a vegetative state. In other words, they found that she couldn't do anything anymore, and the only way that she would survive is if she had life support. Now, listen, life support means lots and lots of different things. Does it need a ventilator? Of course, we have to breathe. But for somebody like her, it also means hydration. If she can't swallow and drink water, well, we got to give her an IV. And if she can't eat, well, she has to have nutrition. So that's a feeding tube that goes down into your nose and throat and stomach in order to give her nutrition. So poor Karen Ann Quinlan was on a ventilator until 1976. Her parents were mortified because she was on there from age 21 until 1976, and they knew this was not the kind of existence. It wasn't a life. It was just the existence that she had, and they didn't want that for their daughter. There ensued then the lawsuit, the fight for the right to die for Karen Ann Quinlan. I can't imagine as a parent, you know, you've already gone through something so completely unexpected. You're devastated because your beautiful daughter has unintentionally ruined, destroyed her life. Trying to wrap your mind around that, holding on to hope, only to be told, well, sorry, there's nothing we can do, but we're just going to keep her going in this vegetative state. And so for years, she was on that ventilator. And they fought, and they did win. They won in the court to take her off the ventilator. Now, to their surprise, she lived another 9 years after she was off the ventilator. They didn't ask to have her feeding tube removed or her hydration. And so Karen lived another 9 years. But that was the way they wanted in accordance with their belief. They wanted their angel to be called home under our higher being's direction and not because they dictated to remove those things. Unfortunately, she died from complications from pneumonia, again, 9 years after she was on that ventilator. So today, Carolina, if we wanted to make sure we weren't going to fall into a situation like Karen Ann Quinlan, there's something called a living will. You'll hear it called an advance directive for a natural death. It's our one opportunity to be able to dictate to the doctors and dictate to our healthcare power of attorney that if we're like Karen Ann Quinlan, we are unconscious to a high degree of medical certainty. That's a legal standard. The doctors are not guessing. They've tested and they've determined we're never going to regain our consciousness. That is the legal document that if we do it when we're competent, when we are alive and competent and vibrant and can make those decisions and we're old enough, which is age 18 here in North Carolina, where we then tell the doctors, hey, listen, if you find me in that state, here's what I want you to do. Where we tell our healthcare power of attorney, which probably at that point would have been assigned to Karen's parents, so we tell them what we would want. But in this case, because Karen, albeit she was an adult, didn't have any directives, it was too late. And so the family had to go fight for Karen's right to die. Now, pretend for a minute that Karen didn't have a living will, but she did have a healthcare power of attorney. And the reason I say that is because with our younger individuals, it's really difficult for them to look at that document and contemplate those scenarios. You know, the reason why is because we all think we're going to live forever, right? And that's why we procrastinate here in the United States, because our perspective is very optimistic, and we don't think, hey, listen, I'm going to lose my life at age 21. And so it's hard. I mean, this is that particular document, that living will, is the hardest document for me and our clients to go through, because emotionally it's difficult, but it's a pretty complex document as well. So even if Karen did not have that living will, she said, I don't want to make that decision. I want mom and dad to decide. If Karen would have had a health care power of attorney, it does give authority to the health care power of attorney to make those end of life decisions for her. But in this case, she didn't have one. So it's all up to the doctors, and they get to throw all the medical trials and testing to Karen over all these years. Now, from a practical standpoint, I have clients look at me and I say, you know what, I would not want to be hanging out here because of the medical bills. So true. Somebody as young as Karen, you would really hope that she'd have a chance to recover. But to be on life support for that many years, her parents just did not feel that that was what Karen would want, and it wasn't what they wanted for her either. So they did win that lawsuit. Now let's talk a little bit more about the health care power of attorney. And this is so true, particularly today in our pandemic status. I've heard, you know, recently, I have my spouse. We all got COVID, and they were in the ICU. I could not go see them, did not have a health care power of attorney. The doctors were kind enough to give me a little bit of update on my spouse, but I couldn't direct his treatment. I couldn't tell them, don't put him on a ventilator or do put him on a ventilator. I couldn't okay if he got sepsis for them to remove his leg. They were going to do it. They had to do it medically. I couldn't decline it because I didn't have a health care power of attorney. So that health care power of attorney, don't think about it as end of life. You fall in the parking lot, you break your hip, you have to have surgery. And when you wake up, you're all looped up on pain medicine, and they ask you where to go to rehab, and you said McDonald's Playland. So your healthcare power of attorney, we use them pretty much throughout our lifetime. When we're at a point where we're not cognitive or enough to be able to make our own healthcare decisions, that's why we appoint our healthcare power of attorney. Often it's our spouse, it's our kids, it's our parents, it's our friends. It's somebody who usually cares about us, and I always encourage our clients to have one named initially and have a backup in case something happens to your first one named. When you have that healthcare power of attorney, if anything goes awry, forget end-of-life decisions, but if anything goes awry, let's just put you under anesthesia. I heard this one recently. Somebody was under anesthesia, and they nicked their spleen while they were trying to do something else, and the decision had to be made, do we take their spleen or not? Well, there was no health care power of attorney, so the doctors made the decision. And it was not what the patient on the table would have decided, and it's not what the spouse would have decided, is what they told me. So this health care power of attorney is super important from the time we turn age 18. You know, we actually have what's called a parent preparedness packet. Imagine your 18-year-old is driving down the road. They are in a car accident. You call the hospital to find what's going on, and they won't really talk to you. They can't share medical information. You're dying to know what caused the accident. It was a single car accident. Dover, did they have drugs in their system? Were they drinking? What was going on? And they can't tell you. They can't because, number one, you're not the healthcare power of attorney. Number two, because of our federal privacy laws called HIPAA, their Health Insurance Portability Accountability Act. that HIPAA release protects from anybody just calling in and getting information. We have to affirmatively give authority to someone for the doctors in the billing department to share information. So your 18-year-old, they should have a HIPAA release, a healthcare power of attorney, and a financial power of attorney at the very least. If Karen Ann Quinlan would have had these documents, her parents would not have had to spend all the money fighting through the court, all the money through the medical bills and treatment that she was receiving for all those years. And they probably would have found a greater level of peace knowing that their daughter was at rest instead of being in this vegetative state, being kept alive by artificial means. Super important documents. You know, let me really tell you when it's too late. I have a great Aunt Jewel, God rest her soul, by the way. And, she was such a fun aunt. She was a blue-collar worker. Her and her husband, they never had any children. They were married for years. They worked in a tobacco factory in North Carolina. And her husband passed away 20 years before she did. Actually, I think it was pretty close to 30 years because I think he'd already been gone 20 years when I married into the family and met her. Now, she was retired, and she loved to quilt. She was active in her church. She lived across the street from her brother, so they had a lot of communication and would have dinner and all that good stuff. Her brother had kids, and so her nieces and nephews would come over and visit. She was a very, very lively, fun, sweet person. Aunt Jewel suffered a massive stroke. She was living alone, though, and she lay there after her stroke for quite a while. Somebody found her. She was alive, but Aunt Jewel ended up in the nursing home. And Aunt Jewel ended up in the nursing home for 11 years. Aunt Jewel did not have a plan. She did not have a plan in place. It was devastating because her house, which I had been into many times, had to be sold. It wasn't in a plan where if she needed long-term care, that it would be protected. Now, I understand that she doesn't have kids and her husband was gone, but I'm sure that, you know, as hard as Aunt Jewel and her husband worked, they really didn't want to work all their life and then lose it all. I don't know what she would have done with her assets if she had something left, but because she didn't plan and it was too late to put a plan in place, at least from her family's perspective, her whole life work, all of her assets, money, house, everything was lost to pay for the nursing home. Standpoint, if they would have sought counsel, if Aunt Jewel would have had a power of attorney, then they could have protected her assets after 5 years, at least here in North Carolina. Well, how's that so, Stacy? Well, it's called, when I do it, it's pre-planning. We pre-plan to protect people's assets. I want to make you look poor on paper in order to protect your assets in the event of these type of catastrophes. We can do things like look at other alternatives like long-term care insurance, life insurances that will advance the death benefit to pay for any long-term care. But in this case, when you don't plan, there's not a whole lot of options. I always say when the unexpected happens, you get a medical diagnosis. You have a brand new grandbaby that's born with Down syndrome. Your spouse passes away or suffers a stroke. Those life events should cause you to take pause and look at your estate plan. This isn't a one and done deal. It's never a one and done deal. You can't just check off the box and decide that I've done it, I don't need anything else. The laws change, life changes, people change their mind. And you need to have a current plan in place. Now, you've already heard me say everybody over age 18 should have a healthcare power of attorney. Sometimes it's known as a healthcare proxy. A living will, you'll hear also referred to as an advance for a natural death, as well as a HIPAA release that allows the doctors to talk to your healthcare power of attorney or whoever else you put on that HIPAA release so they can share medical information to make really good decisions. For the majority of people, when you start grow up a little bit, but when you get married, you buy a house, you start having kids, any one of those things should cause you to ramp up your estate plan. Now you need to have, at the very least, a will. Now, a will doesn't do anything for you while you are alive. It only takes effect after you are gone. But at least you didn't leave it to the state, because listen, if you don't have a plan, if it is too late and you are gone, the state has a plan for you. You know, we have seen this happen more times throughout history than you can imagine. I want to give you some examples. Jimi Hendrix, you know, well-known musician, he died in 1970. He did not have a will. His estate, turmoil, and they battled over it for more than 30 years. Because he didn't leave a will regarding the distribution of his estate, and because it was complicated by the fact that, you know, musicians and artists, they often continue to generate money that belongs to them, and when you're gone, to their estate, it kept everything open and in turmoil through the court probate process. Now, wherever Mr. Hendrix lived, the laws of that state would dictate who does get his assets. In North Carolina, our intestate laws, they're not the way that you would think. So if Jimi Hendrix were married, for example, and he died without a will, then that means that North Carolina will determine how those assets are supposed to be distributed. Everybody thinks if you're married, well, they must all go to my spouse. No, that's not the case. People are surprised. We're dealing with an estate right now, and the gentleman kept telling his family, don't worry about it. I've got it all taken care of. Don't worry about it. I've got it all taken care of. And just because you own assets jointly does not mean that they automatically go to your spouse. In that case, the laws of North Carolina, he did not have a will. They did not find a will. The laws of North Carolina dictated that the spouse got the first $60,000 of the estate. He had two kids, but one of his kids had passed away before him. But that kid had two children, so he had two grandkids. And so the state laws said, okay, spouse gets the first $60,000, but then we're going to divide it a third to his spouse, a third to his one living child, and then a third divided equally between his deceased child's children. Fortunately, money was not really a problem in terms of needing to support his spouse, but to you, that is not the way that he would have wanted it at all. You know, another famous person who died without a will was Bob Marley. You know, like Jimi Hendrix, he certainly continues to generate pretty significant revenue despite the fact that he died in 1981. Now, he died without a will even though he knew he had cancer. And when he found out, he was still around and competent for close to a year. But let me tell you, the worth of his estate was reported at around $30 million, and everybody crawled out of the woodwork. Lots of people trying to stake claim to the estate. And that's not unusual. One of the reasons why it's not unusual is because whether you die intestate, in other words, like Bob Marley without a will, or you die with a will, it's public. Anybody can go into the estate division, the probate court is what it's called here in North Carolina, and look at the court file, and they can raise their hand and try to claim a stake. I'm a sister. I'm a half-sister. I'm an illegitimate child. I'm a cousin, whatever it is. And so under the laws of the state, it has to find the family tree, the heirs. And so then they have to jump all the hoops with trying to prove, are they related or aren't they related, and what line are they in? And so his, too, was quite a mess. Now, while Bob Marley, of course, he had a diagnosis, pretty much knew that the inevitable was going to happen, still, he just wasn't ready. I don't fault him. I deal with people like that all the time. I try to make it as easy as I can. It's not a complicated process when you work with a really wonderful and caring lawyer. We make the difference because it's not about the paperwork. It's about you and your family having heartfelt discussions, learning your goals, discussing all the what-ifs to get you to a point where you go, that's it. That's my perfect plan. That's exactly how I want things to be. That's exactly what I don't want to happen. So don't let that happen, Stacy. You know, even though we all know we are going to die, there's no doubt in my mind, and there shouldn't be a doubt in anybody else's mind, that we will not live forever. There's not a person around that has lived forever. You'd think we would be planning a lot sooner. You know, Forbes magazine did an article, I think back around 2016 or 2014. It was called America's Ostrich Approach to Estate Planning. And it was so cute. It showed a man with his head stuck down in the sand. And we really do. We go, la, 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 la. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to talk about it. What an amazing difference it would make financially to our families, emotionally to our families, if we would just start doing this when we turned age 18. It's not a complex process. It's not a complicated process. It will make things, it's not an expense. It's an investment. And that's the way you have to see it for your family. It's an investment. You know, Sonny Bono, he's another one of those famous individuals who, he tragically died, of course. You might recall he had an untimely death when he was in a skiing accident in 1998. I believe, if I recall correctly, he ran into a tree and at a pretty high rate of speed, and he suffered a head injury. Now, interestingly, because he died without a will, his widow, who was Mary Bono, she headed down to the courthouse where she was applying to be appointed the estate's administrator. In other words, she didn't know what to do, and she goes down there to try to get a handle on his affairs. She has to have authority from the court. Little known fact, his ex-wife, Cher, who, well, she showed up, and she decided that she was going to try to be a claimant of Sonny Bono's estate. Also, a love child surfaced right after that, making the whole situation unbearable for Mary Bono, and very difficult. That's never a situation I want any family to be in. I don't care how much money you have or how little money you have. Death and money do strange things to people. There will come a point in time when it is too late. If we all knew when it was going to be too late, I'd like to think that we would be more proactive, but I've walked into the nursing home and the hospital and worked with 93 and 96-year-old individuals who finally accepted that they're not going to live forever. I understand. It's just a journey, and mentally and emotionally, we have to be prepared. You know, with Thomas Walters Law Firm, we're a multi-state firm. We have offices across the state, and this is all we do is we focus on estate planning and wills and trusts. We don't want it to be too late for our families. I'm a very empathetic person, and I care. I feel the struggle, the stress, the sadness, the grief, the anger when the family is struggling because either there wasn't a plan in place, there wasn't a current plan in place, there wasn't the perfect plan in place. Things didn't flow the way that they thought it would. It wasn't simple. It wasn't easy. You know, we've talked before in the past about revocable living trust, and we're going to revisit that again because that's such a key piece to making things simple and easy so that it's never going to be too late in that event that you have a revocable living trust. Thank you all for listening today. It has been my absolute pleasure to be able to educate you and teach you again. I hope you have a fabulous evening. Happy estate planning. Thank you.
You are listening to the News for the Soul Radio Network. Call in to live News for the Soul shows daily for intuitive coaching, readings, numerology, leading edge health information, and much, much more with featured hosts from around the world. Go to newsforthesoul.com to join the next live show now. That's newsforthesoul.com.